Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Cambodia has had some very tough history, dragged into the Vietnam War, tortured by the Khmer Rouge, then slowly opened to the world again with its great temple city at Angkor Wat. My guest today has gone way back, back in the jungle, to bring out the story of a civilization nearly lost, carved in stone, the ancient Rome of another continent and its Rosetta Stone. This hour on Point, we're looking at the empire of the Khmer. You can join the conversation. Have you seen Angkor Wat, seen the pictures, the root-covered stone faces of Cambodia? Do you know the story, the history? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll talk with Ethan Holtzman, founder of the alt-rock band Dengue Fever, which got its inspiration and its lead singer from Cambodia. Joining me now from Washington is John Burgess, former longtime correspondent for The Washington Post. He has a long history in Southeast Asia. Now he's gone on his own Indiana Jones Da Vinci Code journey and come out with the story of a lost empire. His new book is Stories in Stone, the Sedok Kok Tom Inscription and the Enigma of Khmer History. John Burgess, it's great to have you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks. Hello. Thanks for having me.
Truth in Lending, we're old pals, did a lot of work in Asia together, neighbors and all the rest. John, this is a great story. Some people will know it, a few lucky ones, many others not. Give us the Indiana Jones bit first. Take us in the Wayback Machine, John. There you were, the late 70s, just after the Khmer Rouge, and you were in the woods looking at the vine-covered temple.
That's right. We all at some point dream of being an archaeologist, stumbling across something fabulous in the forest. And this was the closest thing that I will ever come to that. I was covering, interviewing refugees after the Khmer Rouge were overthrown. A huge camp had just sprung up almost overnight right on the Thai-Cambodian border. And one day, I was exhausted. I just went for a walk in the forest to have some time alone. And what did I come upon but this enormous stone ruin sitting there by itself off in the forest, overgrown, deserted. It took me a while, but I realized that I was seeing something from the ancient Khmer Empire that I'd never heard of and that nobody had told me it was there. So it was a real feeling of discovery.
And what you were looking at was a I don't know what you might call it, a cousin or a tendril of the great Khmer Empire, sort of reached its structural apogee with Angkor Wat, that whole Angkor region in western Cambodia on Siem Reap. This is the legacy in stone of a vast empire. Remind us, you call it the Rome of Asia, Southeast Asia. What was the Khmer Empire and when?
Well, that's right. Angkor Wat is getting a name, but Angkor Wat is just one fabulous thing in an area that has countless fabulous things out in the forest. The area was the capital of a great empire for more than six centuries, starting in 802 AD and running to usually 1431. That's the date most historians give. So, six centuries. This was the capital of an empire that sprawled all over mainland Southeast Asia. It included Cambodia, of course, and parts of Thailand, Laos, Vietnam. So it really was the Rome of that part of the world.
It was a Hindu empire, or began that way.
That's right. Hinduism originated, of course, in India, and somehow, in the first millennium, we don't know exactly how, it spread to Southeast Asia and became the religion of the elite, of the kings, of the priests. And all of these temples, well, most of them, were built in honor of different Hindu gods. The area became later became Buddhist, but Buddhism is in many ways an outgrowth and deeply influenced by Hinduism.
And in these amazing structures, and again, people may have visited back when you were around, almost nobody there. For many years, no one could go to the Angkor region, Angkor Wat. Then a trickle. I was there in the late 80s when they'd have maybe 100, 200, 300 maybe in a year, they were hoping. Mm-hmm. Now it's a million a year to Angkor Wat and Bayonne and the others. We've seen these enormous stone faces with those incredibly evocative jungle roots having grown over them over the centuries. You're right that they were trying to build cities in stone so wonderful that the gods could come down from heaven and live in them.
That's right, and the gods are there. You see them in carvings. You see them in freestanding stones. All of these temples are symbolic representations of what the Hindus call Mount Meru, the home of the gods. This is the place in heaven, basically, which is inhabited by the great Hindu pantheon. And you see them. They do actually look like mountains when you think of it.
Whoso views this ideal abode foremost on earth or merely hears it spoken of, his mind is at rest, his soul is sanctified. And this comes from the stone that's kind of at the heart of your book, John, kind of the Rosetta Stone of this empire, which found its home in that temple you found covered in vines.
That's right. Now, the temple that I saw was a sort of relatively small provincial temple, though it's still large by anyone else's standards. The outer walls run about 300 feet by 300 feet. There's a huge holy reservoir attached with it, which is maybe a quarter of a mile long. So we're talking about something really big with, central sanctuary and libraries and processional avenues, quite a place. But it was a provincial place, and it was the seat of a family of Brahmin priests who for 2.5 centuries served the kings in the capital in Angkor. And around the year 1050 AD, the patriarch at that time of the family sat down and wrote a history of his family, running 2.5 centuries, beginning with the very foundation of the empire on top of a holy mountain. And one of his forebears was there with the king when this sacred ritual was conducted and the Khmer Empire came into being. So because we have this record of this family, we have a record of the first 2.5 centuries of the empire. We are given all the names of the kings, we're given dates, we're given the major events of the empire, the foundation, the movement of the capital back and forth, and little hints here and there of civil unrest, of insurrection.
This is the sort of architectural foundation of that part of the region. Is it really this empire, which in enormous part was kind of overgrown and to many thought lost, is it still the cultural foundation of this region? Is the culture of the Khmer great imperial era still coursing through the cultural veins today?
Absolutely. If you look at the royal courts, both in Phnom Penh, the capital of Cambodia, and Bangkok, the capital of Thailand, you see many of the same rituals being carried out that were carried out 1,000 years ago. Both of those courts still have Brahmin priests who, even though they're not Hindu anymore, rather the societies aren't Hindu, conduct old Hindu rituals like plowing ceremonies to assure a good crop. Another thing where you see it everywhere is language. The Sanskrit language, which was the language of the elite in the Khmer Empire, is heard everywhere in words in Cambodian and modern Thai. If you want to talk about religion, if you want to talk about politics or philosophy, government, any of those things, you're using Sanskrit words. And of course, if you go into a Buddhist temple, you are seeing deities, I mean, other than the Buddha, who are essentially Hindu deities who were adapted by Buddhism and whom everybody in those countries knows.
What do we know about the culture that was there, though? I mean, if you go in Angkor Wat, you know, I've walked along those rubbings. They're magnificent. The temple itself or Bayonne, I mean, they're absolutely magnificent, but they're also kind of forbidding. And there are a lot of people, I think, depicted in the stone carvings, the bas-relief on the walls, who look like slaves.
Well, this has been one of the big questions of how did they build those fantastic places? You know, the scale is just hard to imagine. Around Angkor are 2 5-mile-long reservoirs, 5 miles by 1.5 miles, which were built entirely with hand and elephant power. You see them in satellite photos, and they just dwarf the runway of the modern airport. There's been a lot of debate over whether slaves built these things or whether the people at large built them. And I'm of the feeling that the people at large built them because building them was a way that you made merit and you reserved a place of honor for yourself in the next society. I find it very hard to believe that these incredible things, which are so beautiful, so evocative, could have been built entirely by people who were forced to do the labor.
Here's the question that runs in my mind. I don't know if we can answer before the break here, but if somehow they're building, trying to build cities great enough for the gods to come down, if that kind of ambition also ran maybe amok somehow in the Khmer Rouge era. I mean, they had their year zero and their dream of building an all-new civilization, maybe good enough for their gods, whatever those were. Did you ever make that connection, John?
Oh, yes. Basically, every modern Cambodian government puts Angkor Wat on its flag. It's at the heart of the Khmer national identity. And the Khmer Rouge just went overboard with it, and they saw themselves as the inheritors of this great, great tradition in which these incredible things never before seen in history had been built. And they said, well, by God, we're going to put, you know, everybody to work 18 hours a day doing the same thing.
Ancient song behind us here performed on a uniquely Khmer instrument. Same instrument can be found on the walls of the temples in Cambodia, what's now Thailand as well, dating back hundreds and hundreds of years. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. About the lost, nearly lost civilization of Southeast Asia, the great Khmer Empire, and its record in stone on the Thai-Cambodian border, from the mighty Angkor Wat Temple to a remarkable text from 1,000 years ago. John Burgess is with us. His new book is Stories in Stone, the Sadok Kok Tom Inscription, and the Enigma of the Khmer History. He compares it to what? The Rosetta Stone, maybe the Hammurabi Code. Many people around the world know Cambodia best, and sadly, from the Khmer Rouge era. 1984 film The Killing Fields chronicled the rule of the Khmer Rouge in the 1970s. Here's a scene where Khmer Rouge soldiers capture Phnom Penh, expel foreign journalists, forcing Cambodians to remain. It's angry, it's rough, and genocide followed. Death upon death, the skulls were piled high. John Burgess is looking at the beauty of an ancient civilization. John, feedback here online from Facebook. Gustavo says, fantastic, I'm headed to Angkor Wat for the new year. Here's a comment from Shiva. Says, can you comment on the possible relationship between South India and Cambodia? He says, I could see a lot of similarities in architecture, religion, music, song. What do you say, John?
Yes, there are certainly a lot of similarities. The writing system is the same. The general outlines of the temples seem like something you could see in South India. So the general historical theory is that basically a lot of South Indian culture was sort of transported by Brahmin priests, by traders perhaps, royalty, Cambodian royalty who went to India, and brought back and established in Cambodia. But that is not to say there wasn't already an indigenous Cambodian culture. So in many ways you had Hinduism grafted on top of a culture that had been there on its own for many centuries before that.
And then how did the Buddhism come in? I mean, these are temples who eventually had a lot of Buddhist stone statuary as well. A lot of it stripped in years of turmoil there, ending up in galleries and museums and homes of the rich around the world. But how did Buddhism come into that imperial picture?
Well, with a lot of turmoil, actually. Buddhism was there as a sort of secondary religion for many centuries, even while Hindu was the dominant faith. It's unclear, but there are different theories. One is that the collapse, the ultimate collapse of the Angkor civilization and the vast shrinkage of the empire led people away from Hinduism as a faith, the feeling that it was connected with the old order and we now needed a new faith. But another way in which Buddhism came in was simply the king adopted it and essentially made it the state religion. And late in the Angkor history, you can see a back and forth, almost like Protestantism and Catholicism in Europe, where one king would be Buddhist and establish these temples as Buddhist place, and the following king would restore Hinduism and set everything back how it had been. But ultimately, Buddhism prevailed, and that part of the world is now overwhelmingly Buddhist.
Your Rosetta Stone, your inscribed stone, brings us a lot of flavor to this. It opens up right at the beginning with "Praise be to Shiva, whose nature is proclaimed wordlessly yet thunderously by the subtle soul life of his body," and on. Read us a little bit, John, though, about, you talk about the kings going back and forth. These kings could be pretty fierce. There's a reading here where the king is described in the inscriptions on the stone from the temple you stumbled onto in the jungle.
Right. Well, the inscription gives us an idea of what the ideal king was supposed to be. And this is a description of the king who was on the throne at the time the inscription was written, around 1052 A.D. And first, his traits as a scholar, as a man of virtue. It says, "There was once a sovereign of the Lord, whose feet were clasped by all kings, whose part it was to cause the hearts of men to unfold as lotuses, who dispelled all gloom, and who by reason of his splendor was named Udyaditya." And then we hear about him as a warrior. It says, "In battle he wore a sword, he bore a sword red with the blood of enemy kings it had slain, which cast a dazzling light in all directions, like a ravishing red lotus issued from its calyx, which by sheer strength of arm he had ripped from the hair of the goddess of war."
We've got scholarship and we've got blood.
So we see kings
are supposed
to be both.
Yes, yes. We've got it all. John Burgess is with us. His new book is Stories in Stone, and they really are amazing. From the part of the world you may have seen, you may not. It is an exotic and fantastic world, the remnants in stone of the Khmer Empire. Let's go to Tupper Lake, New York, and Sudai. Sudai, you're on the air. Hello, Sudai. You're on. You've got your radio on, so it's hard for you to hear us. Let's get another from Foxborough. Call again, Sudai, with your radio turned off. Foxborough, Massachusetts. Sean, you're on the air. Sean.
Hi.
Hello.
I was concerned about, yes, I'm concerned about all the booming construction, the new hotels, restaurants, all the people moving to the area. I have a feeling that this will be the end of Angkor Wat with all the tourists coming, because it seems like the water table is collapsing and the sewage is running amok, and I think this is going to have effect on the actual temples.
Sean, have you been? Have you been in the area?
Yeah, I've been there probably 20 times at least.
As a tourist, as an aid worker, as a what?
Well, I programmed some software for the casinos around Phnom Penh and Poi Pat.
Oh, good heavens, the casinos and all the... I appreciate your call, Sean. I mean, John, it's true. A million visitors a year now to Angkor Wat and all kinds of construction going on around there. When you were there, when I was there, there was nothing. I mean, nothing. There was still fighting around there. What about what's going on now?
That's right. Well, if you go back now, you'll see two things. The Angkor Park, as it's now called, is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and it is preserved. The area of the temples has no development, no hotels, no restaurants, well, a few restaurants, but it has been left for the temples alone. About 3 or 4 miles south of there, in the town of Siem Reap, it's just one giant construction site, and hotel after hotel going up, you know. You can pay as much as you want for a hotel there now, you know, $2 for a room full of mosquitoes, or, you know, $500 for some fantastic place with a concierge downstairs. You're right. There are beginning to be environmental issues. Water table is one of them. Another issue is just the wear and tear of people's feet on the steps of these temples. They were built essentially only for kings and priests. There were no crowds going into these places. And now there might be, 30, 40, 50,000 pairs of feet.
Wow.
Going across a particular stone avenue in one day. You can still actually go almost any place you want in any of the temples. A few of them have roped off areas where you have to sort of look from afar. But this is certainly an issue and something that that they need to deal with.
Lots and lots and lots of feet where there were almost none for such a long time. Let's get a call from Anchorage, Alaska. Warren. Warren, you're on the air with John Burgess.
John. I'm listening to you, and you said that slaves couldn't have constructed those monuments. But I go back to my slave family, who was the ones that built all the South. They were great craftsmen. It's not because they were slaves, because they enjoyed their work. And when you enjoy your work, whether you are in chains or not, you're going to do a good job. And a lot of my folks passed that on to the next generation who wasn't slaves. And by the time the Irish and the Italians came in, they took all that work away from them. So
pleasure in chains? I don't know, but clearly there's incredible commitment in these carvings, John. I mean, it's just they are beautiful, and they are what can seem like endless.
Yes, I think we sort of agree here. I think whoever built those places had to have a real commitment to the construction, to the job, and to get something personal out of it. And you're right, that doesn't necessarily rule out people who were forced to do the work. If they were forced to do the work, maybe they found some personal fulfillment in it.
You mentioned all the people that are there and what's happening with that. There's a lot of money in this region now. Cambodia is still quite poor, but China rich. There's this week in Phnom Penh, a press conference on Wednesday, announcing a huge new film coming, Hollywood-style, The Great Khmer Empire, which is supposed to star Chinese action movie star Jet Li and maybe Angelina Jolie. I mean, there you were, John, alone in the jungle looking at these things, and now $70 million headed into a major motion picture about your era.
That's right. It's not the place. It's not the place that it was. Certainly, a lot of Southeast Asia is booming. Most of those tourists, certainly a large portion of them, are people from other Asian countries. Actually, South Koreans are the biggest foreign tourist group in Cambodia these days. And you go to Phnom Penh, and they're starting to get their first high-rise buildings. And so, yes, there is a lot of money coming into that country.
John Burgess's moment of solitude with Khmer Empire, soon to be a major motion picture. John, stand by. Joining us right now from Berkeley, California, and we're very happy to have her, is Kateria Um. She teaches Southeast Asian Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, was a Cambodian refugee who first came to the U.S. as a child in 1975, very little English then, lived in one of those refugee camps. Professor Um, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me on the program. Just a small correction. Actually, my home department is Asian American Studies.
I'm so happy to have that. Thank you for that. Tell us, how do you see the importance of this ancient empire in the life of Southeast Asia today? Is there a direct line of influence, or was the line broken and lost at some point?
No, I really think that these monuments continue to hold tremendous significance for Cambodians. And as Mr. Burgess had indicated earlier, that they are very much tied to the Cambodian national and cultural identity. I mean, in fact, they're not just edifices. I think they are the repositories of culture for us. And the nation's political history, the genealogy of its leadership, myths, artistic traditions, I mean, even mores, the notions of crime and punishment are all visibly captured in the temple carvings. But it is also important to note that these cultural remains are not just relegated to the past. And again, this is a point that that Mr. Burgess had mentioned earlier, that there is an uninterrupted connection to modern-day Cambodia and Cambodian culture, from rituals to games to tools, clothing, that you see depicted on the walls of some of the monuments are exactly what you can still see in contemporary Cambodian society. So, in fact, there is that very clear, very direct, very uninterrupted connection to the modern-day Cambodia. I think the other point that is also important to remember, and it was sort of again referenced earlier, that most of these monuments are living monuments. They are sacred places where Cambodians still go to worship, mm-hmm. where you still hear Buddhist chants, where people still go to meditate and enter into hermitage. And there are also communities living around many of these historic sites. And for them, the monuments and the temples are really integral parts of their everyday world. Elders still go to sweep the temple grounds, and children bathe in these century-old reservoirs. So I think that it's really important to keep that in mind, that they're not just...
just archaeological sites, very much. And John reports on that. Let me ask you that. I mean, there's clearly a very beautiful face to this and to the traditions out of it. At the same time, your family lived through the horror of the Khmer Rouge years. Is there a philosophical connection there between the ambitions of the Khmer Empire to make that perfect heaven on earth in these structures and maybe ambitions gone amok, awry in the Khmer Rouge years? Or is that a stretch, Professor? How do you see it?
Well, just sort of to a minor correction, my immediate family escaped the Khmer Rouge barely, but the rest of my family members perished pretty much under the
right.
Khmer Rouge. I think that the notion of the potential, the hidden potential and latent potential of the Khmer people, and in some ways Angkor symbolized, you know, all that we once were and for many Cambodians still could be, that is a thread that that is very much present, you know, through many regimes. The Khmer Rouge, unfortunately, took it, you know, to an extreme level. And again, the notion that the country could produce, you know, the triple amount in terms of its agricultural produce, and certainly that that sense of economic and self-sufficiency rest on the ability to master the control over water will have to mean huge agro kind of and irrigation projects. So in some ways, yes, they took it to that extreme level without consideration of the other constraints that were confronting the people and the nation at the time.
John Burgess, you're right. You're very aware of the way in which these structures, even your little kind of outlying temple, which has ended up across the border in Thailand with modern borders, still very much alive.
Yes, that's right. Even in the 20th century, before it was reconstructed, this temple was a holy place for the surrounding villages. And traveling Buddhist monks would periodically take up residence in this ruined temple and meditate and sort of draw on the spiritual energy of the place. And local villagers would go out and give offerings and say prayers there. It has since in recent years, the temple has actually been reconstructed by the Thai Fine Arts Department and is now both a religious site. There's one Buddhist monk in residence there, and it's also a sort of tourist and educational site. It doesn't get a lot of visitors, but some of those visitors are busloads of school children who are out on field trips.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great Khmer Empire and its record in stone on the Thai-Cambodian border, from the mighty Angkor Wat Temple to a remarkable carved text from 1,000 years ago. Later in this hour, we're going to hear from the American alt-rock band with a big Cambodian flavor, Dengue Fever. But right now, John Burgess is with us from Washington. His new book it'll be available in the U.S., in November, John? Out already in Cambodia and Thailand, I guess. Stories in
That's
Stone.
Right, November.
Yeah, good.
You can pre-order it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and place like that, but it will actually be available in November.
There you go. Stories in Stone, the Sadok Kok Thom inscription and the enigma of the Khmer history. I should say, we have a big photo gallery up of ancient Cambodian temples, ruins, John's Temple, among others, at our website right now, onpointradio.org. And we're happy to be joined from Berkeley, California, by Kataria Um. She teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, a Cambodian refugee herself back in the day, now on top of Asian American scholarship here in the U.S. Let's go to Washington, Vermont, and Derek. Derek, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, what do you know, Derek?
Well, I was working at the National Rehabilitation in Laos for 2 years using music and art as a therapeutic tool with war victims, blind and deaf. All over Laos and into southern China, I just wanted to ask Mr. Burgess, there are statues of a god or goddess, a Hindu, with a long, thick, arcing piece of hair, and the hands are on it twisting that hair, it looks like, at the end. And I just wondered which god or goddess is this could be.
Any idea, John? It's a bit outside your purview, but we've all seen these amazing carvings. I mean, Apocalypse Now had its version in fiction. What about up Laos Way?
That is a goddess, who I'm blanking on her name, but I'm
Hindu, Buddhist.
Well, originally Hindu, but adopted into Buddhist mythology, as almost all of these gods are.
Kataria, does it ring a bell with you?
Yes, in terms of vernacular culture, I mean, just the common folks' adaptation of it, and I believe that you may be referring to what we would call Niang Gong Hing, which is the goddess of Earth, the Mother Earth, and the twisting of the hair referenced a legend or a myth where she did that to soak up the water and hence saved a very important historical figure. So the draining of this lake during a very important historic moment. So that may be the figure that you're the statue that you're referring to. But my understanding is only based on sort of the vernacular folk adaptation of this.
Kataria, it's very interesting to look at these ancient sculptures, particularly of faces. And then when you visit Cambodia today, it is obvious these are the same people. I mean, the facial features still remain that kind of strong, square architecture of the face. Not everyone, of course. There's, right. There's multiculture everywhere. But it is overwhelmingly quite recognizable.
Yes, it is true.
John, here's a comment from Facebook. Kent says, he loves hearing about this, and as you relate the Khmer Empire, sort of the ancient Rome of Southeast Asia, but the civilization rose and vanished, he writes, without Westerners ever knowing it existed. Is that true?
Not 100%, I think. There were a few Westerners, a few missionaries coming and going. But I think it's almost true to say. Basically, the collapse of the empire is normally dated to the middle 1450s. After that period, the Angkor area was abandoned and the royal court was moved to the Phnom Penh area where it remains today. Mm-hmm. And the forest just moved in.
The French certainly felt as though they were discovering it in French colonial
era. Yeah, they felt that, but obviously the Cambodians always knew it was there. There remain villages in the area, and people knew it was there. What they didn't know was the history of the place. To them, it was the realm of the gods that had perhaps been built by giants. And the 6 centuries of history had basically passed out of human memory. And the French arrived and colonized Cambodia in the 1860s, and they very quickly set out to apply scientific analysis to this place and to try to recreate the history, the kings, the main personalities, the main events of what was clearly a fabulous long-running civilization. And they did this primarily by learning how to read inscriptions. And, the Sedokhok Tum inscription is the greatest of the inscriptions, but there are more than 1,000 of them, etched onto doorways. That's a favorite place in temples, or etched onto freestanding stones. And there was a decades-long scholarly effort, which still goes on today, to try to put all these little pieces of the mosaic together to come out with a common understanding of what happened for these 6 centuries.
Here's a question, John, from Catherine. She said she was there last year, and her guide said that all the temples, when seen from above, maybe satellite, lay out the pattern of a constellation of a dragon across the landscape. Urban legend, or what do you say, John?
That one I'm not familiar with.
Kataria is there a dragon in the whole layout?
I mean, the whole the naga is a very important
snake
symbol
figure
in our cultural tradition. Now there has been some studies that shown that the mapping, sort of from the satellite mapping of the temples, did indicate this one theory some alignment with the planets, and so there's this kind of astronomical kind of implications, and it's certainly very very scientific. There's been theories around, again, the alignment of the temples with the equinoxes. So I think that there are these different theories floating around. But it is true that there seemed to be something very deliberate and perhaps even very scientific in the placement of the temples.
John, you mentioned reservoirs, water, irrigation, very important. Many of our listeners are asking, was climate change a factor in the fall of this civilization, this empire?
That is one of the theories, that around the time Angkor was abandoned, there was a very long-term drought. And this was clearly a society, an economy, a political system that was based on water. Everywhere you go in Angkor, they're not as spectacular as the temples, but you will see reservoirs and canals and bridges. And control of water and the movement of water around the plain on which Angkor sits was a big part of Khmer thinking. They were great hydraulic engineers. So, yes, there has been evidence of a long-term drought which may have helped persuade the people there that the future lay to the east. Other theories are military pressure from the Siamese, who are the Thais today, who were expanding and getting bigger at that time and pressuring the Khmers from the west, and also a collapse of this hydraulic system. The Khmers just built too much, and they got to the point where they just couldn't keep it up anymore. That's one of the theories.
Tanya first at the University of California, thank you so much for joining us this hour. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
And John Burgess, author of Stories in Stone, the Sedokkok Tome Inscription, and the Enigma of Khmer History. John, you really open our eyes. Thank you so much for tromping around in the woods and bringing it all out for us.
Okay, well, thanks very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
John Burgess, longtime correspondent there for The Washington Post. The book out in Cambodia and Thailand right now, out in the U.S. in November. You can see a gallery of photos of the Cambodian temples, Angkor temples, at our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, Cambodian music meets American alt-rock. This is On Point. The band Dengue Fever knows a little bit about Cambodian culture. The L.A.-based alt-rockers with a Cambodia-born singer have fused Cambodian street pop, American alt-rock, and some flavors all their own. They've won a following here, and they're about to go on tour in Australia. Dengue Fever's co-founder, Ethan Holtzman, joins us now from Los Angeles. Ethan, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, good to be here.
You're headed out to Australia. What's your tour there look like?
Oh, it's going to be, I think we're going to fly to Perth and play there, and then Sydney, and then Melbourne, just a quick little 10-day, three-show event.
We've just been hearing all about ancient Cambodian history. Tell us about your band history and how it came to be that, you know, an L.A. band with a little kind of psychedelic tinge turned Cambodia style.
Well, that was fascinating stuff you guys were talking about. Well, I traveled over to Cambodia in like 1998. I spent about half a year backpacking in Southeast Asia, and it was in Cambodia where I came across this really nice body of music, and I just collected as much of this music that I could, the cassette tapes. And a couple years later, I was, you know, forming a band with my brother, Zach, and we started kicking around the idea of doing a Cambodian psychedelic rock band based on this music. And we learned about six of the songs, and we're playing with our drummer, Paul Smith, and then we had to find our singer, and we kind of lucked out having Little Phnom Penh in our backyard about half hour's drive from Los Angeles, and that's the second largest Cambodian population, or the first outside of Cambodia. So we began to scour the scene, all the nightclubs, looking for a singer, and eventually we met Chomni Mall, and she was the perfect fit, and we've been playing music for about 10 years now.
She's pretty incredible. You guys are too. It's a marvelous fusion. Let's hear a little bit more. Here's Tip My Canoe from the sixth album of Dengue Fever, Sleepwalking Through the Mekong. Hey, clearly not her as the lead singer there. What's going on vocally there, Ethan?
Well, in this song, my brother, this is a cover song from one of the tunes we heard from the 60s. And my brother, Zach, is singing in Khmer. It's a duet. So if you hear the song, you'll hear towards, you know, the latter portion, Nimal will come in. So it's kind of a male vocal, female vocal, and there were a lot of duets that were kind of part of this music that kind of thrived in the late 60s, early 70s, right before the Khmer Rouge came in.
This is a long way from classical Cambodian music. I mean, the fusion of rock and Cambodian culture was all there before you guys arrived. Cambodians had really jumped on it. How did that happen, Ethan?
Well, I mean, it seems like with Vietnam going on, it just kind of, the radios and the music, the Doors, the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, it just was being, you know, blasted. And the countries are so close to one another that it just bled across. And the Cambodians, they interpreted kind of Western psychedelic rock and roll, and then they infused their own traditional musical elements, and it was just this phenomenal product. I mean, the music that Sin Sisimuth was the main songwriter back in the day there, and he had some really incredible musicians and singers like Rosary Sotia and Pen Ron. They were their voices. It really adds a unique element to it all.
Then it jumped the Pacific with Dengue Fever, and it jumped back. Here's Dengue Fever playing in Phnom Penh on May 13th this year, marking the 60th anniversary of U.S.-Cambodian relations. You can hear the cheering crowd. Applause in Phnom Penh for the U.S.-Cambodian alt-rock band. Here's Tiger Phone Card from Dengue Fever.
Call you from my hotel room.
Chomni Mall, the singer there, well-known to Cambodians before she joined your band. You've been at it for a while now, Ethan. What about this cultural fusion behind the musical fusion? How do these cultures fit together?
I think they fit together nicely. It just became really important. I think that, like, Dengue Fever, we began to take on another role helping preserve this music and helping shine a light on it. So it's just been good. I think for Cambodia now, we're working with an organization called Cambodia Living Arts, CLA, and that's exactly what they do. They teach kids traditional instruments from Cambodia and singing and dancing. So when we were over there just in May, we did a benefit for them, and it raised a bunch of money for their organization. And it's just such a positive thing to see these kids. They're so passionate about the music, and they're really talented. So we're actually hoping to go back in early 2011 and do a tour of all the major cities in Cambodia with Cambodia Living Arts.
And your American audience is now? Are there a lot of Cambodians in the audience alongside, you know, old American kids, regular American kids?
Yeah, it's always a good mix, you know. There's a lot of Cambodians that come out, and there's a lot of, you know, just it depends on what city you're in, but there's always a healthy mix.
Ethan Holtz,
we're having a lot of fun. We're recording our new album right now. We just signed with a new record label called Concord Records.
What's the album going to be called? Do you know yet?
Oh, no, it's a little too early for that, but it's going to be coming out in spring of 2011, so I have a couple titles, but I have to...
We'll look for it. We'll look for it. Ethan Holtzman, co-founder of Dengue Fever, thank you very much for being with us.
All right, thanks for having us.
Great sound. Thank you, Cambodia and California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Have a good weekend. We'll go out with 1,000 Years of Tarantula.